from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. Getting caught up in a conversation here off the air with Timothy Egan, and want to welcome to the program. But let me talk about the book that he has just published recently. It followed the death of his mother, and, well, the book didn't follow it. A journey he took followed the death of his mother. And during that time of crisis in the Catholic Church, he's a columnist, by the way, the New York Times, he decided to examine his own connection to the Catholic faith. He's a self-described skeptic by profession, and he embarked on a 1,000-mile, months-long journey to Rome along a medieval pilgrimage route. And he reflects on that quest in his new book, A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of Faith, and joins us now to discuss his journey and hope much more, time permitting. Welcome, Timothy Egan.
Great. So great to be here with you, Michael.
Delighted to have you here. And let's first talk about the pilgrimage. What drew you to it?
So just two things. The death of my mother was a very powerful thing. She was a devout, progressive Catholic, mother of seven. Great reader, great lover of history, nature, and argument, and never lost her faith at a time when most of her kids did lose their faith, and a time when the Catholic Church was going through this global crisis, which is still in, over sexual abuse. And I held her hand on her deathbed as she slipped away of a glioblastoma, a brain cancer.
And I lost a sister-in-law in glioblastoma. It's a horrible disease.
Horrible. It happened so quickly, too. We thought she had so many years ahead of her. And she said, Timmy, I'm not feeling it. I don't know what to expect. I don't know what's ahead. For the first time in her life that I knew her, she had doubt. And as these things often happen in your life when you lose someone, it takes a while for it to percolate into the soul. And that's what happened for me. Eventually, a few years passed, and I could hear her voice saying, I don't know what's ahead. So I felt an obligation to explore my own very complacent thinking on spirituality. Like a lot of us, I just let myself go flat. So that was the first thing. And then the other thing was at the dawn of the Trump era in 2017, which is when I did this pilgrimage, I was just looking for something more durable. And what is more durable than the palliative of history?
Well, also, the palliative of faith is even more durable in many ways. I think of what you've said about your mother, and I think about Rose Kennedy, who right at the end said, after having two sons killed by assassin bullets, said, I have my faith, and her faith could sustain her. But even doubt, for the most resolute minds and hearts of faith, can seep in, as it did
Mother
for
Teresa,
mother.
On her death, it was the same way, said, my God, I'm not hearing anything back.
Well, and you use eternity in your title here. I mean, think about Kingdom Come and all those Irish Catholic notions of eternity. And you're a Jesuit-trained guy, so I mean, it's in
don't
your—
Don't go there. Don't go there.
Well, but it's in your DNA, I think, isn't it?
It is.
Jerry Brown used to talk about that. I can't escape my Jesuit education.
I'm sorry. I am a prisoner of my Jesuit education, but I consider it a blessing, too. Also, the reason I talk about eternity is because this was once the Via Francigena. It was the most popular pilgrimage trail in the Middle Ages. A million people a year followed it. And if you went there, you could get your sins absolved, and that would buy your passage, ensure your passage to eternity.
Camino de Santiago is a much better known path, though, isn't
correct,
it?
In Spain, and that gets up to a million people a year. This is arguably more glorious, certainly more historically resonant. There's not a place along the trail that something miraculous or moving or historic happened, and it's prettier.
And you really seeped yourself in this. You absorbed all this history and certainly took you into many questions of faith. Also took you through, four different countries, I think, doesn't it?
Yes, it starts in Canterbury, crosses the English Channel, goes to Calais, wends its way through most of France, gets into the Alps in Switzerland, crosses Great St. Bernard Pass at 8,000 feet, and then gradually down climbs all the way to Rome.
You were a fallen away Catholic, or as we used to call them, a lapsed Catholic, really, right, when you went on this journey, right?
That's correct. And, you know, 50% of all American Catholics are lapsed. It is the largest segment of Catholics. Well, if you add one to it, it's the largest segment of Catholics. But, you know, I have a chapter on the labyrinth in here, which is you see these labyrinths along the way in some churches. And I say, as a Catholic, once you get into the labyrinth, you never get out. So I'm never get out. Also with Pope Francis, whom I'm very impressed by and continue to be impressed by, I call myself now a lapsed but listening Catholic.
Well, you were also on not only historical pilgrimage, but also on sacred ground here, right?
That's right. And thank you for noting that. I mean, so many of these places where I stayed were the places where miracles happen, and supposedly miracles still do happen, and places where, you know, kings were crowned with oil that came down from a dove from heaven. Every king in France was crowned in Reims by oil from heaven, right on the Via Francigena. And many of these places, so much history happened, so many miraculous things happened as well. So you can't help but to feel the sort of glow, the power. You're starting in Canterbury itself, where Thomas Becket was hacked to death. It's an 850-year-old crime scene that still is one of the top pilgrimage places in the world.
When you mention France, it also brings to mind, I mean, there's still a majority of Americans who believe in miracles, a majority of Americans believe in God, and probably kingdom come as well. But I was reading an interview you did, and you were talking about France and talking about how Macron spoke about Notre Dame when it went on fire as the epicenter of France. And yet, what, about 3% of French people now take Mass?
Exactly. So here's the interesting thing about Europe right now and the Via Francigena. 50% of Brits have no faith at all. And they say within 50 years, Christianity will basically disappear in Britain. And France is a nominally Catholic country. 90%+ of the people say they're Catholic, but only 3% of them do practice it. But then you had the fire in Notre Dame. And as Macron said, it made many people realize this is something that's deep in our culture that's not easily shaken.
I think you also make us mindful of the fact that the Catholic Church has now, in perhaps the most crisis period that has been, one could even argue, since the Reformation. Your own personal history involves sexual misconduct by clerics. And so to some extent, you were looking for, I don't mean to be presumptuous here, but you were looking for a way to kind of put this into a context and make it all fit for you.
No, you put it right. So I say that I'm going to give you my journalistic side and I'm going to give you my personal side here. It's tough to merge the two sometimes because I prefer the third person remove, which is more comfortable. But the Catholic Church is going through its worst crisis since the Reformation, when Martin Luther rocked it 502 years ago, and it was over indulgences, selling a passage.
King Henry helped too, of course.
Well, then he's the man who started a religion by being a wife killer.
Exactly.
So this is truly an existential crisis for the church, and we don't know if they'll be able to resolve it. Every corner of Catholicism, you continue to hear about the sexual abuse crisis. My own family, among the seven children in our family, one of my brothers was victimized by this, and he lost his best friend who was also victimized. As an older man, he threw himself in front of a train. And my brother will never, ever, ever forgive the church for the cover-up, he said it's like the mob, the way they, you know, protect their own. My mother did forgive the church. She kept her faith. I was more in the middle. And so one of my challenges on this pilgrimage with a pope I really respect who genuinely is trying to resolve this thing was, can I forgive this church for what they did? I've seen the pain in my own family. Can I forgive them? And that becomes one of the driving motifs of the pilgrimage.
Indeed it does. And it's also kind of a maternal desire. I mean, you lost your mother and the church is the mother, the mother
exactly.
Church.
You know, I hadn't thought about it that way, but you put it well.
And we're talking to Timothy Egan, columnist for the New York Times. His new book is A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. And he'll be appearing tonight, 6 o'clock, at Book Passage in the San Francisco Ferry Building, and tomorrow evening at 7 at Rakestraw Books in Danville. And you can join this conversation. We have certainly talked a great deal here on Forum about, well, we've put the spotlight on, so to speak, because of that famous film about abuses in the church, coming out of the church and the hierarchy protecting and simply making those abuses part of business as usual. We'd like to hear your thoughts, though, and like to hear any questions you might have for Timothy Egan, who has been, I'll have to say it, really exceptional as a journalist with that third-person column that he writes, but it's not always just such a third-person column, particularly when he starts talking about the toxicity of the present presidential administration. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and you can join us now toll-free, and I invite you to do that. The toll-free number to call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. You do write about religion a good deal, too. In fact, a recent column, I think it was last Sunday, you were writing about Mitt Romney and the Mormons and saying maybe they present a whole different Mormon Republicans, a whole different – maybe
the Mormons are the most – Pew's done a survey. The Mormons are the most Republican of all the major religions. And among the Christian faiths are the one that's least likely to support Trump because they're appalled by their personal behavior. And also they have a tradition of you know, Latinos are the fastest growing part of Mormonism right now. So now, I mean, here's the problem when you talk about religion in the contemporary realm right now. You hear about the sexual abuse and then you hear about the evangelical community giving cover to an outwardly amoral and unreligious president. And so that turns so many people off about religion, especially young people.
As far as you use amoral, there are those in the church who simply don't reckon with you know, Stormy Daniels and all that, which would be deemed by them, at least in terms of their religion, as immoral.
Okay, I would go along with that, yes. But so that's what they hear about. And I'm trying to go to the core of it. I'm trying to do something that human beings have done forever and what we still have a desire to do, which is take a pilgrimage to force the issues. And I recommend it to anyone who's been lazy in their spiritual thinking. It really does force the issues.
Just so people understand, you didn't walk the full 1,000 miles.
I got badly injured twice. Tore a quad in my upper right leg and had terrible blisters because I didn't listen.
Well, there's always a good, it seems to me, virtue in learning how to listen. I had to do that to a great extent behind this microphone, and I think I can actually say I've learned how to listen pretty well. But it's very important in life, I think even in a moral sense. So is, speaking about moral senses, so is what you call digital cleansing. It's not your original term, but a
Correct.
Necessity. Yeah.
So what, another one of the reasons to go on a pilgrimage is to get out of the ADD world we're all in. And I'm as bad as anyone else. I'm hooked to this sort of dopamine-induced loop of texts and tweets and emails and responses from people. And just to change your life and put it in a different rhythm, which is what a pilgrimage does. So I spent several different times nights in monasteries where these men take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They eat dinner in utter silence, and there's no Wi-Fi. And if nothing else, it forces people like me to change my rhythm. And you know, I got kind of appalled at myself that I was incapable of deeper thinking and deeper reading. I used to, when I was in college, I loved to read Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and the great masters and wrestle with these big questions. And then, you know, now I think in you know, 20-second sound bites. And that's what digital cleansing does. It takes you away from that.
I must confess, I was thinking about, I was talking about it with Denzel, our producer, actually our senior editor, about doing, he goes on these retreats, Spirit Rock, which is not far from us. Mm-hmm. And there's retreats of silence. And I think you can gain a lot by that. You can kind of get your head clear and you can take in things and maybe bring things up that weren't there before.
So I was at 8,000 feet at the Great St. Bernard Pass, which is the high point of the Via Francigena. I had a discussion with a priest who had been a former medical student. So he was a man of reason, logic, and science who became a priest when he had a religious epiphany. And Benedictine, taking the rules of St. Benedict, I said, what advice can you give me as a pilgrim who still has 500 miles to go? And he said, what you said earlier, Michael, he said one word, listen.
Let me read some comments that are coming in. Britt says, does your guest speak Italian? How did speaking Italian or not speaking Italian affect the quality of his journey? And overall, he wants to know how you prepared for your trip.
Abbiamo parlato bene italiano. Two ways to prepare. Physical, of course, because I walked about half of it. And especially in Italy, there's always a glorious hill town at the end of the day, but it's brutal because you're tired and you're exhausted. And then there's another 1,000 vertical feet before you can have 3,000 calories replaced with a terrific meal. So I walked a lot of stairs and did a lot of running and things like that. The harder thing was to just to get myself in the right mindset. So I read a lot of stuff. I took a lot of different theologian types. I'm not a theologian at all. I consider myself really just an average guy trying to look at some of these big questions. So I did sort of a spiritual prep, which I say right up front in the start of the book, it was the hardest part. I atoned. I forgave a man who I'd been in a feud with for 30 years, although when I told him all was forgiven, you know what he said? Oh, are we in a feud? He wouldn't even justify my feud. So I tried to clean some—
You did this without AA, too.
Right, exactly. So I tried to clean some things out. And it's what the pilgrims of the medieval, they would, you know, they would make arrangements for their wife to remarry. They would forgive, you know, the people who they were mad at. It's sort of the process you're going through of decluttering emotionally.
And in many respects, you met some fascinating people along the way. I mean, it's almost your own Canterbury Tales.
It really is. And the Canterbury Tales, of course, were birthed from pilgrims going to Canterbury after Thomas Becket was hacked to death in 850 years ago. Most of the people I met on this pilgrimage trail were not people of faith. They were not practicing Christians. They were atheists, agnostics, and somewhere in between. And there were people like me trying to force the issue. And most of them did come to some resolutions. They did force changes in their life. And most of them had some spirituality that they couldn't give definition or context to.
Yeah, when you mentioned atheism and agnosticism, I think you were on with Stephen Colbert, and I can't use this language, of course, but he was talking about an agnostic being someone who doesn't have the I think you can use the word cojones, maybe.
Cojones, you can use
that. I think it's acceptable.
He said an agnostic is an atheist without cojones.
Yeah, but you know, Studs Terkel said something much more apt to me a number of years ago. He said, I'm an agnostic, and what that means is I'm a cowardly atheist.
Yeah, that's true. And I say, you know, when you're a lapsed Catholic, you're someone who doesn't believe in hell, but you're sure you're going there.
There's a comment from a listener named William I want to read here. He says, for months between 5th and 6th grade, I lied to my mother every Sunday. I told her I was attending church. Instead, I would try to reconcile why I felt my participation in the Catholic Church was dishonest. The church's message wasn't at all what I imagined Jesus would promote. Why did my participation feel like I was condoning lies? Belief is one thing. Denying reality and being dishonest to myself wasn't tolerable any longer. I was done. Fairly early age. But a lot of this comes out in your work, if I may say so, Tim.
Yeah. I went in as much as possible, Michael, with a very open mind. I said, strip yourself of your cynicism. Strip yourself of your skepticism and all the snarky stuff I've said about religion as well. I said, go in fresh. But looking at the history of institutional religion, particularly Catholicism, it doesn't hold up very well. But looking at the gospel, it holds up better. Now, I'll just give you one example. The church has been tied in knots for so many years over homosexuality and condemning of gays, not allowing gays. They're still against, you know, marriage equality. So I finally go back and read every word of the New Testament, all the four Gospels. You know how many times Jesus condemned homosexuality?
Zero.
Zero. There's not a single word that anyone can point to. So where did they get this thing with gays? Where did this obsession with denying people who are gay of their basic rights come from?
Well, you know, the psychoanalysts say some of those who are most homophobic don't like what they may feel certainly is under their services. It was interesting, in fact, when Pete Buttigieg came to this kind of interesting repartee with his fellow Hoosier, Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, and said, you know, how do you explain the fact that your creator made me and I believe in him?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I'm very impressed by what Pete Buttigieg is trying to do in the contemporary realm right now, which is say, look, how dare you hijack faith and make it all your hate-filled version of it? I'm a man of faith. Pete Buttigieg says this. I'm a Christian, and my gospel says I don't have to hate. And, you know, in the public realm, progressives are afraid to join this. They just don't know the language of it.
You write about a nun, for example, who works with migrants down in Texas, and how much she has impressed you and really is doing what we used to call God's work, which is unfortunately all too often something people don't do anymore through the hypocrisy and corruption and all the rest of the things that unfortunately have given religion a bad name, seems to eclipse the kind of work of people who are really doing that work.
Exactly. And they don't get any attention. So at the start of this journey, I go to Calais, which was a big refugee center for people fleeing all the conflicts in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And the police round them up. They live in something called the jungle. They're cowering. The people assault them. They're just treated horribly there. The people who give them food and allow them to take showers and show just a small modicum of human decency to them is a small group of Catholics trying to live by, as you said, that nun is. And they take their cue from the gospel passage in Matthew that says it's how you treat the least among us that will be determined by how you will be judged.
In fact, Jesus teaches one to love the poor.
Exactly.
Perhaps maybe above many other things. And let me bring
prisoners, too.
And prisoners, yeah, the forsaken. Let me bring a caller aboard here. Peter, that's you. Hi. Join us.
Oh, hello. Yes. I've done a lot of the pilgrimages over the years. And last year I did the Via Francigena as well. And this year across Spain, the Camino Levant. And I would, one of the things that I've found about, there are many, many aspects about doing the pilgrimage and benefits from it. And I absolutely agree about digital cleansing and so on. But I think one of the most, I find the most interesting thing is the communion, is having a period of time where you have to have a communion with your body. That is, and a real appreciation of that potential for discovery as a result of that. And what I mean by that is you have to pay absolute close attention to how your body is working, how it feels. And it's actually setting up a dialogue. Well, that's how I look at it, literally a dialogue with the body. And as a result, there are obviously when things feel painful or ache arises, then you pay immediate attention to that. But in the process of which, and it is meditative, that the journey itself is a meditative one, and ideally one focuses on the actual process of walking itself. The aches and pains within the body helps one concentrate as a result.
Peter, I'm glad you brought up that physical side of a pilgrimage or long walking or anything along those lines. And let me, you write about this, Tim, yeah?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I couldn't agree more. You do. I had to listen to my body. I hadn't been, and that's one of the two things that pilgrims talk about more than anything is how beat up they feel.
Can I tell you? There's a comment coming in from a listener. Please tell me what you did to avoid blisters. But that's another question.
No, the blisters are a whole side chapter. After reading Cheryl Strayed's book Wild, I said, "Damn it, I'm not going to write a book about a pilgrimage that has anything to do with blisters." But then I got horrible blisters in the Alps, and
you didn't get bone spurs, did you?
No, but I got.
Sorry,
but let me just finish because. He raises a very good point, and I heard some advice. I think it actually was from Pope Francis to pilgrims, and he said, a pilgrim should allow yourself to be amazed, which is, you know, just to allow yourself to be surprised, to allow serendipity, those things to happen. The other thing is that I heard a lot from fellow pilgrims this term, I don't know if the caller heard this, of deep walking. You know, that the walking is the process of meditation and thinking through issues, but also listening to your body as well as it's putting you through a painful ordeal.
Let me thank Peter for that call. We'll go to another call here in just a moment. Well, let me go to you next. Jesse, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I just find myself feeling more and more irritated as I listen to this. If it just seems to me like self-indulgent, upper middle class spiritual tourism. If you guys have this much time and money on your hands, why don't you come to the Richmond Rescue Mission and volunteer? And if you want to put your body to task, why don't you walk the landfill loop trail and pick up litter?
Well, I think most people who are on a pilgrimage, most people I met, would not meet that description. They were teachers, they were students, they were people taking breaks in life. They weren't wealthy at all. The wealthy are off doing whatever the wealthy do. You can do this pilgrimage on a very, very small budget. You stay in monasteries and hostels and you share food with each other. And, you know, maybe as a result of taking a pilgrimage, you will be a better human being who will come home and work in the mission. So I disagree.
And I wonder why, Jesse, you immediately assumed that both Tim Egan and I don't do the kinds of things that you're talking about. Do you have knowledge of what we're doing?
I just feel like it's a waste of money. I just feel like when there's so much going on in our country that's so I'm driving through Berkeley right now. I'm looking at all the homeless. We've got them in Richmond, too. I just think it's self-indulgent. Sorry if you disagree.
Well, we can disagree or agree to disagree, but I don't disagree with the basic premise. I think one needs to do whatever one can to ameliorate problems like homelessness. Mm-hmm. That's why I talk about it as much
as
I do.
I'd just say, again, I don't think it's a bourgeois pursuit at all, not based on the people I saw. Most of them were on shoestring budgets.
You know, we just want to get a response to you from something that just came kind of over the wire, and that is that President Trump, Attorney General William Barr, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently, you may even be aware of this, gave speeches on the role of Christianity in America and in the Trump administration. What do you think of mixing Christianity with government?
So one of the things I concluded in this book was that the original sin of Christianity was when church became state. And also the genius of the American Constitution is in our First Amendment that ensures that we will never have church-state union. Christianity started as a small sect that was a religion of love and tolerance and a somewhat radical philosophy of loving the least among you. And its great mistake was when the Roman Emperor Constantine decided to make it the state religion. And from there on, they killed heretics. One of the first things that Charlemagne did after being crowned was to behead 5,000 Saxons who wouldn't convert to Christianity. So when I hear these things about Pompeo and Pence trying to, you know, merge what they represent in government with faith, I think it's just a continuation of the great original sin of Christianity.
And you go back even to the Crusades. I mean, you take us back in this historical journey and make us realize all the bloodletting that was done in the name of Christianity.
Two centuries of utterly senseless slaughter between the two great faiths at the time.
But getting back to church and state for just a moment, if I may, this is sort of a confession. Father, will you forgive me for this? No, but a number of years ago, I was asked to write a column for the Chronicle. And I'm not like you. I'm not a columnist. I don't have those chops. But I was asked to talk about religion in terms of government. And Obama was president at the time. And my take on it at the time was, well, religion is playing a diminishing role in government and seems to be, certainly under Obama, presidents don't go to church regularly. They don't put their religion out there the way they used to and so forth. At the time, I wasn't reading tea leaves, but I was trying to make sense of it. And boy, was I wrong. I mean, because it's become so central now to this administration.
Yeah, but remember that, okay, so it can be used for just for pure power reasons, or it could be used for good. And the Archbishop of Canterbury said something when I started this pilgrimage. He said, no matter where you are on the scale, you can't understand the world today if you don't understand religion. Now, think of the way that Obama used his faith. Probably one of the most extraordinary moments of his presidency, Michael, was after the Charleston, the killing in the church. And he goes to this church and he's with the ministers there and he starts singing Amazing Grace. And it's because he had been no drama Obama for all these years that had so much power when you heard someone like that do that. The civil rights movement was born Martin Luther King Jr.'s sense of true Christianity. So, I mean, faith has a place when it's used properly. When it's used as a power grab, it's a terrible thing.
And you write very eloquently about that duality. Thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you with us.
It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you.
Timothy Egan, columnist in the New York Times. His new book is A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. And he will be appearing tonight at Book Passage 6 at the San Francisco Ferry Building and tomorrow 7 at Rakestraw Books in Danville. Thank you for being a part of our program this morning. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.